Hi, I'm Anne Strandchamps. It's the season for New Year's resolutions, and I have a confession. I don't actually make New Year's resolutions because I can't keep them. No matter what goal I set, doesn't matter, exercise more, drink less, clean out the basement, I always mean to do it, just tomorrow or the next day. And you know what this is like, right? You probably put things off once in a while yourself. Maybe you're even supposed to be doing something else right now instead of listening to this. So today, on To the Best of Our Knowledge from BRI, our subject is procrastination. Why do we put things off, even things we mean to do, even things we want to do, and how can we stop? Here's Pierce Steele, author of The Procrastination Equation.
People fiercely defend their procrastination. They argue vehemently that I'm a procrastinator, it works for me. But strict definition, you're putting off, you have to expect to be worse off. You're putting off despite thinking that you should have started earlier by your own standards.
Don't put off till tomorrow. Yeah. What you can do today. Don't leave things half finished. That's all we've done on that.
It's a huge problem. For example, colorectal cancer is probably one of the biggest killers. And the reason why isn't because it's not treatable if caught early. It's just to diagnose it, you need a colonoscopy. And it's kind of humiliating and it's kind of embarrassing. So people would rather put off dying of embarrassment now and risk dying of colorectal cancer later. So that's the other end. And actually in the book, that's actually exactly what happened to my stepmother. She put it off, and by the time they diagnosed it, it was too late. No, in fact, actually recognizing that we are fallible, recognizing that we're not motivationally perfect, that we have lapses in willpower, and that we don't always make the right decisions, allows us to do something about it. In fact, the people who believe their actually willpower is perfect are the ones actually most likely to get into trouble. So there's actually three major causes of procrastination, contributing factors. The biggest one of those three is impulsiveness. You know, inability to delay gratification. It's wanting it all now. You can be very spontaneous. You're maybe probably a little bit more fun. And you can take advantage of the opportunity as it kind of leaps upon you. But typically, it's unfortunately really kind of cuts its two ways, a bad side effect. It's when vices provide their pleasures more readily than virtues, then the ones most impulsive would be also be the most corruptible. And this is really what causes procrastination, is that we have these long-term but delayed goals, things that are going to provide the rewards, but in the future, like, you know, getting a degree, exercising, quitting smoking. On the other hand, we have all these temptations that pull us away from these long-term goals. For example, you know, Facebook, social media. I mean, I talk about the internet nowadays, and this is why you see a fivefold increase in procrastination over the last 30 years, is that we're all trying to work where there's a casino, a strip club, and a games room.
Goofing off! Goofing off! I'm goofing off! Goofing off!
Height is genetic in origin, but some are small and some are tall. Same thing with procrastination. It's really baked into our brain's neurobiology at a fundamental level. It's because we have not one decision-making system built into us, but two. We have a limbic system, and this is our emotional part of our brain, which responds to immediate concerns and concrete sights and sounds and smells and tastes. Then we have this other, more recently developed, neocortex, literally new bark, the prefrontal cortex, and this is often called the executive function. This is where all your long-term kind of plans and really where the seat of willpower happens. So we make long-term plans, you know, I want to diet, I want to kind of go for that promotion in the prefrontal cortex. But when tomorrow comes, we actually have to enact it, you get these cravings to do otherwise, and through the limbic, the emotional response. So you have people having this conflict, you know, you want to eat that cake, but you wish you didn't want it. And really, procrastination occurs because even though you know you should be doing this and you wish you had the motivation, you only really get going when both systems are finally saying go. And that only happens just before the deadline.
Stop procrastinating, fool. Stop living in a rut. Go get something done right now, or do I have to kick your butt?
Pierce Steele is a distinguished research chair at the University of Calgary. He's the author of The Procrastination Equation, How to Stop Putting Things Off and Start Getting Stuff Done. I guess the big question about procrastination is, how does it make you feel? And if you can put things off without feeling guilty about it, maybe it's just a healthy coping mechanism. Most of us, however, are more like Patricia Pearson. She's a Canadian writer and journalist who's written a lot about anxiety and also procrastination.
The other day, my husband was cleaning the fridge when he beckoned me to stop watching an all-new episode of Pick a Puppy on the Learning Channel and to come into the kitchen instead. Patricia, he said with a certain good-natured vexation, could you somehow devise a more rational approach to leftovers before I file for divorce? Ah, I peered at the shelves in our Frigidaire. There was a recycled yogurt cup housing one-third of a fish stick from the previous night's dinner. Beside it, some Tupperware containing approximately 2 tablespoons of soup. Next to that, a jar with a 1-inch square strip of steak leaning tiredly against a string bean. And on the shelf above, a sip's worth of milk in a glass. The trouble I have here has to do with endings. In particular, I don't like to finish the last bite of food on my plate, and I put it off by saving these bites for some unspecified time in the future when I might wish to have a lick of chicken noodle soup or a dried-out morsel of haddock. Our fridge looks like a picnic hamper for squirrels, my husband said. And of course, the food does tend to become that as each tidbit eventually withers from my ambivalent neglect and gets transferred to the garbage. It is an unusual form of procrastination, I suppose, this tendency to put off consuming the entirety of dinner. But on some level, it's an act of resistance, I think, to living in a culture of haste and consumption. Hurry to the latest version of iTunes and the newest rendition of smartphones and the up-to-the-momentous dining experience. Buy and acquire and nibble and gnaw and rush about at rodent speed. Don't dither, get on with it, seize the day, move your unacceptably slowed down butt along. He who hesitates is lost. Procrastination has fallen into ill repute, and I don't like it. Consider me counter-suggestive. Sometimes I think I would have been a more contented citizen of ancient Egypt, except for the part where one dies of sepsis at the age of 20 and has to spend eternity with a mummified cat, but otherwise, the pace was much more agreeable. For 3,000 years, it didn't occur to anyone in ancient Egypt to change their hairstyle. Century upon century went by, with everyone appearing to walk sideways along walls in the same sort of outfit, carrying similar stuff while sporting chin-length bobs. Everybody worshipped the same divine beings, decade after decade. 3 millennia, and still Anubis the jackal-headed god lording it over the temple. What was a generation gap in ancient Egypt? One generation of women preferred dyeing their hands with henna, and the next generation preferred dyeing their hands with henna, too. At some point, there was probably some seismic shift where the daughters rebelled and decided to use pomegranate juice, but then everyone settled back down to henna. We wouldn't know about it because the scribes took 4 months to carve out a single line of hieroglyphics, what with all their procrastinatory naps, and they had lots to note down about the afterlife before they got to fashion skirmishes and skin dye. Were they wasteful and hurried in the Nile Delta of 2000 BCE? I think not. Where innovation was concerned, they managed to procrastinate pretty much into infinity. And why is that a bad thing? There's no virtue in quicksilver change, and thus no inherent virtue in accomplishing everything now, today. Because what we are being asked to accomplish is suspect, the very idea of procrastination becomes problematic. All right, I tell my husband, having thought about it aloud on public radio, I've decided to modify my approach to leftovers. I will henceforth eat my food, but refuse to buy an iPad or a new pair of shoes. And I will reserve some time each day for deep contemplative thought.
Patricia Pearson is a journalist and a writer. Her latest book is called Opening Heaven's Door, What the Dying Are Trying to Say About Where They're Going. Coming up, we get philosophical about putting things off. I'm Anne Strange-Champs. It's to the best of our knowledge. from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Is procrastination just a bad habit, or is it possibly something worse, like a vice? Okay, maybe it's not up there with envy or vanity or one of the other deadly sins, but maybe putting things off isn't so innocent either. Jennifer Baker is a philosopher at the College of Charleston and author of an essay called Procrastination as Vice. Steve Paulson wondered why a philosopher would be interested in vice.
As an ethicist, what I find so philosophically important about procrastination is how we categorize it in terms of behavior. So is it good or bad behavior? What type of bad behavior is it? Is it a vice or not? Is really my focus. But I think testing vice, testing our account of vice through its application on procrastination just reveals all sorts of things about human nature.
So what does it mean to think about procrastination as vice?
Well, we have to make some decisions. So if you want to consider procrastination to be a vice, then you're going to be taking a non-Aristotelian approach to procrastination. And you're going to be suggesting it's something that can be overcome. And then you have to make some decisions. Is it something that can be overcome through force of will? I think that's really implausible, but a Kantian might say that. Or is it something that can be overcome through choosing better activities? Or is it something that can be overcome through having a more realistic self-image?
Now, getting back to Aristotle, he did not see procrastination as vice, right?
That's what I argue. He has this very nuanced account of choice, and he would rule it out as a vice because it's not something we choose. Nobody wants to be a procrastinator. Nobody makes that decision. On the other hand, people make decisions to have vices all the time. Today we say vice, and I almost think of it as a positive thing, like, you know, roguish qualities or something. I mean vice in the really old-fashioned sense, the unfun stuff. Vice, for Aristotle, is going to have to be something that's chosen. So someone who chooses to be lazy, for example, or a real slacker throughout life, they've made a choice. And if you ask them about it, they'll have a rationale, right? I don't think I should have to do work. I don't like working, right? They'll have all these things to say about their choice. But procrastination isn't like that. We don't intend to become a procrastinator, and procrastinators don't have great things to say about it.
So if Aristotle did not see procrastination as vice, how did he see it?
He saw it as completely typical of human nature. So even if we don't happen to be a procrastinator, or as seems kind of common, we aren't procrastinators anymore now that we've graduated from college, we still are going to have the same problems procrastinators have. So researchers have found there's not one type of procrastination. There are different types of procrastination. Some people seem to be really into the thrill of getting the stuff done at the last minute. So they get a kind of pleasure from that. Some people really like keeping their options open, so they just kind of can't make a decision about what course of action to take. And then some procrastinators seem to have a real fear of being judged by their work, so they just want to put off that work. They're perfectionistic, and so they're never going to be comfortable with what they produce or the idea that it could be looked at by others. But these things, being too into pleasure, being incapable of thinking clearly about a course of action, being way too susceptible to other people's opinions, those are things that put all of us in peril. Those are our challenges as humans. So whether we procrastinate or not, those are the challenges we face.
Now, isn't there another philosophical tradition to thinking about procrastination, again, going back to the ancient Greeks, that perhaps sees it as not such an awful thing? I mean, maybe there are good reasons why people procrastinate.
Yeah, it's an interesting and complex sign, I think the Epicureans and the Stoics would say. So the Epicureans, if you are writing and you find it really difficult to make deadlines, they'd just laugh at you for your interest in writing. You know, why are you doing this? This isn't for you. You're not cut out for this, right? Some people write every day and almost do so compulsively. Let them be writers, right? You're just interested in self-torture for some reason. So they would not take the procrastinating in writing seriously. That's not something you have to fix. But they would take it as a serious sign you need to change your life. They also think there's a type of procrastination that people do it's kind of similar to the classic Christian worries about procrastination, and it's procrastination on coming to terms with mortality. So there are some Epicurean lines, you know, all of life is lost through procrastination. Now, they don't mean finish your novel. They mean stop putting off thinking about life.
Hmm. And then what about the Stoics?
The Stoics have a slightly different account than the Epicureans when it comes to procrastination, and they're going to zone in on your self-image. And they think the big mistake we make is to think the wrong things about ourselves. So this makes procrastination kind of embarrassing. A lot of procrastination is done because we have the wrong kind of self-image. We think we are better than other people. We think our work is supposed to be better. Our work matters more than other people's work. If we just adjusted our self-image and understood that our paper is going to be as middling as the other papers, right? Or if we just were honest and, you know, called our editor and said, I have no thoughts on this topic whatsoever, and I've written a paragraph, right? If we just expose ourselves, we'd have a more realistic self-image. These grandiose ideas we have about our greatness really get in the way of our lives in general, the Stoics think.
Sounds like the defeatist view of procrastination, but maybe it would make a lot of us happier. You know, we wouldn't be sort of tortured by self-doubt.
I tried, and it makes me happier. I recommend it to students.
You're not serious, though. I mean, you're not
saying... I'm serious.
Wait, you are? Isn't the job of the professor to make sure the students do their work and on time?
No, I try and tease them. They get so panicky about their grades, and I try and figure out why they think they will be destroyed by failing a test. You know, why can't they take it? If you earned an F, you have an F. Move on. But they don't see it that way.
Now, the whole business of dealing with deadlines would seem to be paramount in this discussion of procrastination. And for some people, deadlines are what makes them get through life. I mean, without deadlines, right, they'd fall apart, and other people sort of put things off, and then, you know, they're driven to distraction with their stress. The student's life is full of deadlines,
right,
and yet you're suggesting, it sounds like, don't sweat it too much.
Well, if they are waiting till a deadline to study for, you know, right before the test or right before the paper's due to write the paper, they will do suboptimal work, right? But some of that is poor design, I think, on the part of professors, right? We know that happens. So we should assign papers in tiers, they call it. We should assign drafts. They should have to turn in drafts throughout the semester to keep them from working on a paper the night before it's due. I give a lot of midterms because I don't want my students to wait and try and cram philosophy, which I think is particularly tragic. So I give a lot of midterms to kind of fight off that kind of natural reaction to having an assignment you aren't quite ready for.
So your strategy is basically to create conditions where people can't really procrastinate.
Yeah. Now, that's an Aristotelian strategy, because I'm not accusing the students, as I do that, of having the wrong self-image or of having the wrong values in life. But Aristotle would suggest that we all need that type of help.
But it also sounds like procrastination, if we're really honest with ourselves, is a vehicle for personal change. I mean, if we really think about this and think about what makes us unhappy and how we constantly feel bad about not doing the stuff we think we should do, maybe we really need to rethink what our lives are all about.
Right. Very Stoic and Epicurean. That's how they would use procrastination, for sure.
Do you think many people think that way today?
No, I don't. They should. I mean, part of it is that there hasn't been a lot of attention to procrastination. It still seems kind of like a funny subject or a side topic. And so psychologists are, you know, they're doing more and more work on it. So that's great. Maybe it'll get more attention that way. But also, people are very ashamed about their procrastination. So it's not even something we discuss so much. Even if we discussed it more and admitted more to it, I have a feeling these insights would occur to us.
Jennifer Baker is a philosophy professor at the College of Charleston and author of the essay Procrastination as Vice from the book The Thief of Time, Philosophical Essays on Procrastination. She talked with Steve Paulson. Chrysoula Andreou is the co-editor of that same book, The Thief of Time, and she also contributed an essay called Coping with Procrastination. She has a number of strategies to help us stop putting things off, including one borrowed from psychology. It's called an implementation intention.
The idea of an implementation intention is, instead of having a vague goal, like I will lose weight or I will get into better shape, you come up with a way of implementing that in a kind of specific plan. And so you come up with a plan that may be something like, okay, on Monday, Wednesday, Fridays, I will walk home from work. That's sort of not just it's not a vague goal. It actually gives you a way of implementing what you want to do.
So you're sort of breaking it down into little baby steps, and your goal is no longer the great big thing down the line. It's very specific. My goal is to exercise 5 days a week or 3 days a week or to only have dessert on Saturdays.
Yeah, so the two features are it's not vague, it's specific, and also, it, like you said, it kind of breaks it down into a certain series of steps. So it's not just something in the distance where there's no particular thing that you need to be doing at any particular time to achieve it. It's like, I want this vague goal, this big thing, and here's the way I'm going to achieve it. And once you've set out an implementation, there is a sense in which it's not vague anymore. If the way you're planning on doing it is this way, and yet you're not sticking to that, there is a psychological sort of dissonance or a kind of problem that occurs there. And it actually does motivate people. It does make a difference.
Well, my experience as a lifelong procrastinator, frankly, is that I'm incredibly wily at overcoming all sorts of strategies. So what are the negative consequences to this particular strategy?
In this case, actually, one of the problems with the strategy is not so much that you're able to find exceptions, although that's a problem with some strategies, that you kind of look for creative ways of kind of getting out of the, it wasn't supposed to apply in this type of circumstance, in this type of circumstance, I can deviate in this way. In this case, one of the problems is actually, because it's so specific and clearly defined, if you do lapse, it often reinforces the feeling that you're not capable of achieving this goal. So it lowers your feeling of efficacy. And one lapse makes it more likely that you'll actually just give up altogether. So there's the idea that a bright line is good because it helps kind of guide you and be more specific. But if you lapse, it's more easy to just say, oh, forget it, this is too hard, there's no way. And there is some studies in relation to addiction that suggest that, if you have a first lapse, oftentimes you'll just take that kind of resigned attitude of like, oh, forget it, this is just too hard.
Right, that one drink and you decide, well, that's it, I might as well have the whole bottle.
Right, exactly. Because it just sort of reinforces the idea, like, I don't really have the self-control to achieve this goal.
Now, another thing people do is set it up so that there are costs to procrastinating. I can tell you from personal experience, there are an awful lot of journalists who would never write a word if it weren't for their editor's deadlines. That's actually a fairly effective strategy, isn't it?
Yes, I think it is effective for a lot of things. But there are certain areas in your life where external constraints aren't as easy to implement, either because they kind of invade your privacy too much, or there are no kind of socially available kind of prefabricated devices that you could just rely on. So you have to kind of construct a device yourself, somehow get other people involved in monitoring you and stuff.
Oh, this is the thing. If you want to take up running, do it with a friend. When your friend is pounding on your door at 6 a.m, you're going to go ahead and put on your running shoes.
Oh, yeah. And then in that case, your friend really is your best friend because they're a cheap pre-commitment device. If they are there at 6 a.m. pounding on your door, great. That's an external incentive that's kind of available to you. No massive financial cost or invasion of privacy. So I would say in that context, you would gravitate towards something like that and it would probably work quite well. I mean, some people might object that too much reliance on external kind of incentives is actually going to kind of weaken your self-control. And so when that you actually need it in some cases, you haven't sort of strengthened it like a muscle where you can actually employ it. You're relying too much on external constraints. But I would say that in some areas of your life, they're just so convenient and so such a reasonable solution. The cost is not too great. They're readily accessible that it does make sense to use those.
Another strategy you tend to see suggested is, well, it's kind of a variation on how we potty train children. You set up your own system of rewards. So something, more sophisticated than a sticker chart, but along the same lines. Does that work?
Yeah. Part of the reason I think that can work, and that's the strategy I call leveraging control, and that's the strategy that I discuss because I don't think it's been as extensively studied in the literature on procrastination. But at least with respect to adults, I think there is some reason to believe it's not so much that either you're a procrastinator or not, or either you have good self-control or you have poor self-control. It's actually something that varies by domain in your life and by area. And so you can have a lot of, as a professor, you're used to hearing other professors say, and sometimes complaining yourself, oh, these students are such procrastinators. They know they need to do this, but they always just put it off till the last minute. And then you find out sometimes, well, in some cases, they're not procrastinators at all. They're, you know, really disciplined when it comes to their weight training regimen or something else. And I think that's true for all of us, is that there are certain areas in our lives that either through habit or for some other reason, we've cultivated more self-control. And I think we can use those areas to help us gain self-control in other areas by something like a reward system. So if I have a lot of self-control when it comes to, let's say, spending money, I can use that to reward myself for, let's say, sticking to an exercise program. And I know that I will not reward myself unless I've earned it, because I have a lot of self-control with respect to that area of my life. And so can add a little bit of extra incentive. And sometimes a little bit of extra incentive is all you need, because if procrastination sometimes functions as a free rider problem, where part of the reason you put off the thing is because you think it's negligible, it's not going to have a big impact one way or the other. Once you add a non-negligible impact that you yourself are going to enforce, you might be more motivated to stick with the original plan that you came up with. It might add just enough kind of impact to motivate you.
So explain how this works in practice. We were talking about exercising, for instance. So how would you use a leveraged control strategy to make yourself stick to your exercise routine?
As I said, you have to have an area of where you have decent self-control. So let's say the decent self-control is in the area of spending or spending on treats or something like that. You might tell yourself, okay, only if I exercise 3 times a week or walk home from work these 3 days, will I have earned the right to go out for a really nice dinner on Friday night. And I know, again, if I have a lot of self-control when it comes to spending money, I know that I will, you know, enforce that. I really will not provide myself with the reward unless I have done the exercise.
Boy, this sounds really tricky, though, because self-control, I guess it's a strategy that's entirely dependent on self-control, which seems like exactly what the procrastinator has trouble with. So if somebody is already avoiding their exercise program, wouldn't they also simply be likely to avoid their penalty?
Well, that's why the strategy depends crucially on the idea that self-control varies from domain to domain. So yes, the strategy would be totally puzzling if you could just say of people, oh, this person's a procrastinator or this person has poor self-control. But if things are more subtle than that, they have a lot of self-control in some areas and poor self-control in others, then it is actually possible for them to, as I said, leverage their control from one area into another. I mean, the one reason I think the strategy has just seemed kind of puzzling or paradoxical, like it couldn't be true. But if you recognize that, you know, a problem with self-control doesn't have to be a global problem, you know, in every aspect of your life, then it's no longer puzzling. It is a possibility for you yourself to kind of intervene via your self-control in another domain.
Crisula Andreo is the author of an essay called Procrastination as Vice, From the Thief of Time: Philosophical Essays on Procrastination. She teaches philosophy at the University of Utah. When it comes to writing, it's really easy to procrastinate. The temptation to avoid the terrifying whiteness of the blank page can be overwhelming. Canadian philosopher Mark Kingwell has clearly either never felt that temptation or overcame it, because he's written lots of books, including one called Catch and Release, Trout Fishing and the Meaning of Life. Kingwell sat down with Steve Paulson to talk about the chapter Boredom, Procrastination, and Losing Your Way.
The problem with procrastination is precisely that the task you should be doing is the one that you can't do. And yet, when you're in a procrastinatory bind, you're perfectly capable of doing all kinds of things, even very productive things, as long as they're the thing not that you have to do. So the idea, in a way, is to trick yourself into achieving things by doing them when you don't have to do them, instead of doing the one thing that you think you have to do. And by doing these rounds of trickery with yourself, you can actually get a lot done. And indeed, that's how I got my dissertation finished.
So this is very different from laziness. It's not as if you don't want to do anything. It's just that you don't want to do the one thing you're supposed to be doing.
That's it, exactly. And I think the best way to conceptualize this is to see it as a conflict between two different orders of desire. So you have a second order desire, which is a desire about a desire. You want to do the thing that you're supposed to do. But you have a first order desire not to do it, or anyway, you lack that first order desire to do it. And this conflict between the first and the second order is what creates the distress of procrastination. And it's precisely the bind within the psyche itself, which means that you stall on that particular task. So it really has almost nothing to do with laziness. It often looks to the world like laziness because you're not doing the thing you're supposed to be doing, but in fact it is a kind of psychic bind.
But as you say, if you can figure out how to sort of trick your own desires, you can sort of find these smaller tasks that will perhaps get you to finish the larger task.
That's one solution. The classical solution, of course, and this is rooted in really ancient philosophy of mind and philosophy of action, is to try and line up your first and second order desires so that the thing you want to do and wanting to want to do that thing are aligned and you go about your business.
But you'll have to explain that. So give me an example of that.
Okay, so suppose I have a task that I'm set to do, and that is, say, cleaning the house. Because of my sense of duty and orderliness, I want to clean the house. So I have a second-order desire about that task. But what I may or may not have is the first-order desire actually to do it. That is, I may want to clean the house or not want to clean the house. Now, I can overcome not wanting to through sheer strength of will, and that's one kind of solution. I can trick myself into doing it while not doing something else. Or in the best case scenario, at least classically, I should simply have that first order desire match my second order desire. So not only do I want to clean the house, I actually want to clean the house. And here I go, getting out the vacuum.
This sounds like the kind of thing that philosophers talk about.
Well, you know, it's as old as, at least as old as Plato's dialogues, because we know in Plato's Republic, he talks about a character called Leontius, who goes outside the walls of the city and sees some corpses piled after a battle. And he can't tear his eyes away from this ghastly sight. It's maybe the first recorded instance of rubbernecking. And what he says, actually, is he denies and denounces his eyes. So he says, he turns angrily and he says, okay, take your fill of this beautiful sight, you horrible things, his eyes. So he's got a conflict there between his desire to look and his desire not to want to look. And in that particular case, his will is insufficiently strong to stop that first order desire from taking over. And that's what philosophers call weakness of the will, or akrasia. And procrastinatory states of mind are intimately related to that kind of akrasia.
Now, there are also some larger, deeper issues that come into this discussion. I want to quote a passage from your book. You write, "Procrastination most often arises from a sense that there is too much to do and hence no single aspect of the to-do worth doing. Underneath this rather antic form of action as inaction is the much more unsettling question whether anything at all is worth doing." I mean, you're really getting at the futility of existence, aren't you?
Yeah, and it's I really think this is the existential beast that's crouched in the lair of an everyday experience. The initial experience might be something on the order of you open the fridge and you say there's nothing to eat because you can't fix your desire on any particular thing, even though, of course, there are, in fact, many things to eat. And the same thing can arise in your experience of a task. Lots of things to do in any given day. In fact, most of us feel that we're overburdened with things to do. But no single one seems to catch our attention in such a way that we can get our desires behind it. And once that starts to chip away at your sense of purpose, it really does start raising these questions about, you know, all the things that we spend all of our time and energy thinking about doing and maybe even doing, which of them, if any, are worth doing at all?
Maybe there's no point to doing anything.
Well, the famous tag that procrastination is the thief of time strikes me as relevant here because so much of what we do is a function of an immersion in a temporal structure. So we make appointments, we have Blackberries and date books and schedules, and that keeps us really from thinking too deeply about whether any of those appointments are worth keeping or whether those tasks are actually worth doing. And this is what we do to get through the days. But I do think that underneath this fairly ordinary experience of procrastination, there is something really quite profound that strikes us with full existential force.
Well, it sounds like procrastination is perhaps one of the great issues for philosophers, which makes me wonder whether philosophers themselves are more likely to procrastinate, or perhaps procrastinators are more prone to become philosophers.
I think both things are true, and it relates also to experiences like boredom, which has an unexpectedly deep philosophical payoff. Most people think of procrastination as something to be disapproved of. So, and the famous inversion of that is probably De Quincey's, where he's in The Fine Art of Murder, he says, you know, something like, once you let yourself commit an act of murder, you'll soon find yourself by steps committing even more serious things like incivility and procrastination. And he knew whereof he spoke, because De Quincey was one of the great procrastinators of his age, and yet also tremendously prolific. And when you take those two facts into account, you see that is a portrait of a man in a certain kind of perpetual crisis. You know, he's fleeing the deep philosophical lesson of procrastination by trying to work it out through production. And in a way, he's a quintessentially modern figure. But yes, philosophers, I think, they ignore this kind of experience at their peril. And the best philosophers are the ones who take this kind of everyday experience and really start to probe it in the way that we have been doing.
Now, you suggest that actually, if you're looking for a close relative of procrastination, it's not boredom, it's actually addiction. Can you explain that connection?
All of weakness of the will, addiction, procrastination, and boredom can be conceptualized in this difference between first and second order desires. So the close kinship between addiction and procrastination is that the addict, like the procrastinator, has a problem where his first order and second order desires don't line up. In the addict's case, it's the reverse. So the addict has a first-order desire for his or her drug, but usually has a second-order desire not to have that first-order desire. So, you know, I want to do the line of coke, but I don't want that because I know it's bad. So the addict is, in a sense, in a similar kind of spiral, only with the polarity reversed, and each action of giving in to that conflict furthers his or her immersion in the addiction, just like each inaction on the case of the procrastinator perpetuates the spiral of procrastination.
Well, it also raises the question of whether there's something pleasurable about procrastination, about not doing the thing. I mean, can that, I don't know, create joy in our lives, even though we feel guilty about it?
Yeah, you know, you wish that were true. I mean, in a way, the addict is better off than the procrastinator, because at least he can take the first order pleasure in the experience of the drug. Most procrastinators are racked by guilt because the external disapproval is matched by internal disapproval. And that's why it's not the same as idleness, for example. The true idler is able to say, what I'm doing now is nothing. And that's a kind of new scale of value, a new order of activity. The procrastinator is more like the slacker, the person who is aware that he should be doing something else but isn't. And that awareness colors the whole experience of not doing it, such that the procrastinator can never really take any deep pleasure in not doing the thing that he should be doing, because the shouldness of that hangs over the whole experience.
So that person becomes a moral failure in a way.
Exactly. So one of the solutions that I haven't mentioned so far is simply to abandon your projects and actually be an idler. And of course, the idler never procrastinates. The idler is simply doing nothing always.
Seems the great dilemma is always, how can you be both an idler and still maintain ambition? Can you have both those things?
I think you can. I'm blessed because being a professor of philosophy, in a way, is one of the few professions where you get rewarded for being idle, really. I mean, you know, you're writing articles and teaching, but in some larger sense of what the world considers work, you're doing something idle. I think that's a proud banner to bear. But the idea that somehow ambition is always about achievement in measurable ways itself needs to be queried. We're here for a mortal span whose length we know not, and our ambition should really be to make the most of the time that we have, not knowing how much of it there is. And there is no time to be spent feeling shame at not doing things. You should find things that you can do, however, whatever method works for that, and enjoy doing them.
Mark Kingwell is the author of Catch and Release, Trout Fishing and the Meaning of Life. He teaches philosophy at the University of Toronto, and he talked with Steve Paulson. And that's it for our conversation about procrastination. But coming up, web video superstar Felicia Day is on our minds this week. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Say you're born in Huntsville, Alabama. You double major in math and music performance at the University of Texas on a full scholarship in violin performance. You're on track to become a musician or a mathematician. That was Felicia Day's path until she moved to Los Angeles and created, wrote, and starred in a web series about online role-playing games. It's called The Guild. After millions of views and many awards, the success of The Guild led to collaborations with people like Joss Whedon. Felicia Day is the author of a new memoir, and Doug Gordon sat down to talk with her.
Felicia, your book is called You're Never Weird on the Internet, almost, and it's a great title, and it raises the question, why are you, Felicia Day, as well as the millions of others who use the internet, never weird? What is it about the internet that nullifies the weirdness factor?
I think that the internet allows us to connect with people and make us feel like we are accepted and belong in a way that we could never feel in real life. I think if you're confined to the people around you, you might not necessarily be celebrated for all the things that you feel fulfill yourself. And therefore, you might abandon the things that you love because you're not accepted. And the great thing about the internet is that it opens doors around the world to people you can connect with and share a joy of something with and be yourself. And that's, I guess, why I chose that title.
Yeah, for sure. Definitely. Now, you were born in Huntsville, Alabama, and you spent a lot of your childhood being homeschooled. Why?
I was homeschooled because my dad was in the military, and we were stationed in places that didn't have very good school systems, and my mom is kind of a free spirit, so she just arbitrarily decided, well, we don't have any alternatives, let's just not send you to school.
So how big a part do you think that your homeschooling, how big a part did that play in setting you on this path to using your weirdness to create the popular web series, The Guild, and to become web famous?
As far as homeschooling, I think it really is the reason why I'm here. I don't think that growing up in a traditional schooling system with traditional gender roles sort of imposed on me and the traditional paths of popularity or likability or attractiveness, I don't think any of those things would have encouraged me to start, you know, loving video games, turning a video game story into fiction, picking up a camera and thinking I could really take down the system and go around the system in a way that was very naive and kind of ridiculous. Had I known what I know now, I don't know if I would have been brave enough to try because the odds were so daunting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you attended the University of Texas at Austin, and so you graduate from college at the age of 20, taught for 4% of your class, then you decide to go to Los Angeles to pursue a career acting, an acting career. So what were those early years in L.A. like?
You know, they were very difficult going to L.A. with really no connections. It was a struggle, and I started getting very depressed. And even though I made a living with especially commercial acting, I got very depressed. And that's when I started playing video games to the point where I was like, oh, this is a problem.
Yeah, and it really was a problem, wasn't it? This is like late 2005, I think, you started playing this new online game.
Yeah, it's a game called World of Warcraft, and it really was the first MMO to really take the world by storm. An MMO is a massively multiplayer online game. So you have maybe millions of people all over the world logging on at the same time and playing a game together. So it really was the first projected self in an online world that felt very social. In that you're doing something with other people.
Sure, I mean, you're doing it as an alter ego, right? You have an alter ego.
Yes.
Who was your avatar?
My avatar was a gnome. I had a little tiny gnome with very tall hair. And you get together and you go through dungeons, and then you just kind of chat with people, either typing or eventually voice chat. And it really was an amazing thing for me that I let get out of control because I was unhappy in my real life.
How out of control did it get?
I mean, I would play like 8, 10, 12 hours a day. I would wake up and have an agenda, a to-do list for my game. So that was when I had friends around me in real life say, hey, you're playing this game too much. You need to stop.
And you were able to do that? You were able to stop cold turkey?
Well, I talk about it in my book that it was definitely a struggle. I tried to wean myself off and it never worked, really. So I had to go cold turkey and how hard that was. And it was only through a support group that I joined with some other women who were trying to achieve things in Hollywood that really kind of almost shamed me into getting serious about creating something other than potions inside this video game. And that's where the story of The Guild, the web series that I wrote and created back in 2007, emerged.
Yeah. So tell me about The Guild. How did that come about?
It started because I wanted to write a pilot. And when I set out to write something to feel productive about myself, I wrote about gamers because I'd been online all my life.
Mm-hmm. And it became very successful. Although it started out as this real low budget, almost no budget production, it became very successful. And you actually started getting paid to make it. How did that happen?
Yeah, no, it got very successful and YouTube featured us and we got hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of views and it was really a dream come true. And I don't know how I decided to take the path I did, except I just had faith in our audience that we could make it no matter what. That's sort of, confidence that you can't tell me not to make this. I don't need your permission is really a driving force in my life.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. Express yourself, a chance to express yourself and embrace your weirdness. Now, you mentioned The Guild was a dream come true, but it wasn't without this kind of nightmarish aspect because towards the end of doing the sixth season, you were getting stressed out and depressed. In fact, you say that the stress started killing you, literally. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, well, it was really two women making this whole show the whole time. We were essentially making movies every year for, 6 years of our lives with no help. And I personally was so ruled by anxiety in my life because of probably being homeschooled and very sheltered that it got very out of control because I was being pulled in so many different directions. And the stakes, I thought, were so important to keep everything so incredibly successful. So I burned my thyroid out. I have horrible acid reflux that to this day is something I have to deal with health-wise that is very detrimental to my health. And I really entered a massive depression that really took me to the edge of my own mind. And I still marvel at the fact that I'm still here making content because there were many times when I just wanted to pick up and leave and stop everything and just not be a public figure anymore. And because my world was going so fast, I didn't know that I could say no to everything in order to recover myself, which I eventually did because I got help. And, in going around the country talking about this book, the most amazing thing is that people have come up to me and said, thank you for making me not feel alone. Thank you for showing me there's a path out of this. Thank you for just encouraging me to go get therapy and or see a doctor to try to know that this is not something I have to live with every day. I can try to get at least some control or knowledge over myself in order to be able to not be ruled by my brain telling me that I need to self-destruct every second.
Well, one of the things that I really related to was your description of having trouble living in the moment, because that's a big issue for me. You say that you often spend a lot of time panicking about the future or regretting the past, but then after you had some time and you learned to say no to people and things weren't as hectic for you, you reformed your brain to live in the present. Can you explain how you were able to do this?
I mean, I can't say that it's something that I am constant with, but I do have the awareness that, if you're anxious, you try to control everything in order to make sure that things don't come at you and startle you because you don't know how to cope. So being able to cope with startling things or surprising things or unexpected things allows you to be a little gentler with yourself because you know you can deal with it. And in kind of training myself that no matter what happens, whether you're in a car crash or your career goes south or, some horrible tragedy happens to you or you just flub your lines, that will happen, and then you figure out what to do after that. It's okay to have some unknown branches in your life. You can't predict everything that's going to happen. And I think just sort of embracing yourself with that warm pool of acceptance is something that I just try to encourage myself to do, knowing that, we have a beginning and we have an end. And if you're always running, you don't see the path that you're living in. There's no point because it's almost like telling myself that regret is a very sad thing to live with. So always, take the time to acknowledge the moment.
Yeah. You've experienced a lot of success with the internet, but you've also experienced the dark side of the net. Some people, trolls, have said a lot of terrible things about you online, and you actually keep a hate folder on your desktop computer. Can you give me an example or two of the kind of comments that are in the hate folder?
I mean, a lot of the folder is not worthy of reproduction. A lot of it is profanity that you probably would never want to hear. A lot of it is, you know, the most hurtful ones that I get, even to this day, are that Felicia Day is not a gamer. Her career is all built on exploiting people. She shames nerds and geeks. So, you know, in years past, I've struggled with that kind of negative attention and wanted to chase these people down and correct them because they're wrong or I need them to like me. And I think at a certain point, you just have to let that go and know that they're very sad people and they're toxic.
Is there a particular time or event that you can pinpoint as the moment when you fully embraced your weirdness, or are you still working towards that?
I mean, I think when the Guild was accepted by people and it kept being accepted by more and more people, I think I finally felt that I belonged and that I could be myself, because through that story and through playing that character and telling those character stories, I found a sense of truth and connection with people that I had lost in trying to fit in Hollywood. At the end of the day, that sense of acceptance is something everybody should have in their life, because if you're feeling shamed about who you are, if it's a career or hobby, like, that's, you're not surrounded by the right people.
Yeah.
And there is the opportunity to find those people online. And that's why I love what I love and would never just jump away from it for other opportunities.
Felicia Day is the creator of the award-winning web series, The Guild. She talked with Doug Gordon about her memoir, You're Never Weird on the Internet, Almost. And that's it for this hour, but there's more online. And you can hear To the Best of Our Knowledge whenever you want, if you sign up for the podcast. Visit our website and we'll tell you how. That's at ttbook.org. Today's show is produced by Doug Gordon. The rest of the team includes Raymond Tungekar, Craig Ely, and Charles Monroe Kane. Music by Steve Mullen from WalkWest Music. Audio wizardry courtesy of technical director Kirill Owen. Executive producer Steve Paulson. I'm Anne Strainchamps. Till next time.
PRI, Public Radio International.